Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. Once again, we have a special for you. Over the course of this week, it's another two-parter like it was with Jonathan Davis, but this time it is with Hugo Monier. It's brilliant to chat to Hugo for an hour and a half the other week, and he discussed his involvement with the foundation, Looseheads, as well as taking us through his wonderful highlights in his career, as well as his work in the media. So part one, which you'll be listening to very shortly, discusses why he got involved with Looseheads and also his first part of his career, so how he got into rugby and his memories with Harlequins, whilst the second part will focus on the Lions tour as well as his work for BT Sport, and he wraps things up by taking us through his Mars 15. So next up, you'll hear part one of our Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union with Hugo Monier. Hope you enjoy. So hello and welcome back to another Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. I'm your host, Chris Heal. It's brilliant to have you tuning in once again and hope you're enjoying listening to these podcasts in the wonderful weather that we're having at the moment. So grab yourself a drink and settle into this podcast because we've got a very special guest this afternoon. Normally we record these on a Friday afternoon, and as I've just said there, the weather's pretty nice where we're recording it. And normally myself, Mark, Dave and Rob, are the co-founders of Looseheads, take a professional view and we stay professional while we're recording a podcast. But we have got a gin and tonic today, guys, haven't we?
We have indeed.
How are they going down on this Friday afternoon in the sunshine?
A bit too well, I think.
Too well, yeah.
Well, we're not alcoholics. So there is a very good reason why we've got gin and tonics on a Friday afternoon, because our guest has been thoroughly enjoying his gin and tonics during this lockdown while he's been obviously doing the hard work of hosting the Looseheads Instagram Lives. It's a very big pleasure to welcome Looseheads ambassador, Harlequins legend, and a man who's part of BT Sports' superb rugby coverage. It is Hugo Monier. Hugo, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me. I just saw Dave's iWatch just pop up there, and I think he's probably most deserving of it because you've almost closed all your rings, which means you've been really active today. So,
it's the bonus of having a three-year-old dog. He sits whimpering until I've walked him 4 or 5 miles a day. So I don't get a lot of choice in it.
Fair play. Well, gin and tonics all round. However, I have let the side that I'm with a Coke Zero today. But give it an hour, give it a couple of hours, I'll be on to the pink gin and tonics too.
We can give you time now, Hugo, if you want to hop to the fridge or...
I tell you what, that's a great idea. It just doesn't make for a great podcast if we just get silence for 2 minutes.
The magic of editing.
So I'm more than up with this for now.
Okay, brilliant. Ever the professional, Hugo. Ever the professional. So, yeah, like we said there, obviously, Hugo, you're now a Looseheads ambassador, which was announced very recently. And Rob, just to go to you first to introduce, obviously, why you chose Hugo to be a Looseheads ambassador, because we talked off air then about how much influence Hugo's had with the Looseheads Instagram Lives and all the other stuff he's been doing for you guys. So why was Hugo a perfect fit for you?
Yeah, it's great to have someone like Hugo involved with Looseheads. It really gives us that credibility. If you see people like Hugo involved with Looseheads and connect that link to mental health awareness, it shows that we really mean business when it comes to opening up the conversation. And just on that, it wasn't the first time I'd sort of met Hugo as well. So back at school, my team got to the Daily Mail Cup final, the final against Wellington at Twickenham, where we won 10-7. But little old Wilmslow that day beat Wellington. A great day, and Hugo gave me the medal that day, which was class. I sent over the photo as well when we first initially had the chat about Looseheads, which we had a bit of a laugh about. I was actually thinking about this earlier. I hope you didn't actually watch the game, because I think I had the worst ever game in my school career. Only job as a fullback is to catch the ball, and I think I dropped the high ball twice that day.
Mate, I've been there. Don't worry.
Both went backwards, so it's fine, I guess. But no, having Hugo on board is absolutely fantastic for us. He's such a big name in rugby.
Yeah, well, I think Sean Edwards enjoyed sort of your defensive stories from that game, Rob.
Yeah, it's nice to speak defence with one of the best coaches in the world.
I love Sean. I absolutely, I genuinely love that guy. I think the person you are often transfers onto the pitch. He was the very same as a player, uber competitive, and he's the same as a coach. I was lucky enough to work in 2009, and the one thing I took away from it is not only is he just technically just so brilliant, but his passion, his desire, and just, yeah, just everything about it, so geared and focused towards defence that there's not been many coaches where I've gone into a Monday morning review knowing you've missed the tackle and genuinely just scared. And that Sean was one of those coaches because he took it personally. You know, you might have missed the tackle because it was a total mismatch, size, weight, speed, whatever it is. And you're fearing for your life because Sean's like, why did you do that? And it's a case of like, why would you do that against me? Like, why would you let me down in that way? And I think that is a motivation for any player taking the pitch. Hence why he's been one of the most successful coaches we've ever had in these shores. It's just a shame he's never got the top job at the RFU. I've got to say, whenever I bow at the game and we look back at coaches we've had, of course, we've got a brilliant coach, brilliant coaches in John Mitchell and Eddie Jones, but you just feel as if the RFU may have missed the trick not employing Sean at some point.
You did mention the other day on our podcast as well that, you know, wing was the hardest position to defend.
You're compromised, you're exposed. A little bit like a goalkeeper, I think. Goalkeeper's one-on-one, and either the ball goes into the back of the net, you make a brilliant save, and I think that's the fine margin which you live in on the wing, and your position's often so compromised because it's not just plain sailing. We know the game of rugby's so fluid, but you might be put into a difficult position, not because of your positioning, but because of what may have happened two or three phases before, whether there's an overlap, whether the blows and wingers working hard enough, what the fullback's doing. So you're forever compromised. And that's why I think the best wingers, not only able just to be able to like live in the moment and make decisions. We're talking split-second decisions. The picture which was there half a second ago may not exist half a second later. And then to be able to adapt, have that communication, and then pick the right man and make the right tackle. I think you're just thinking about quite a lot of things. So it is a difficult position. I'm glad he said that, because if I say it, it's totally biased. But I love defending. It was a big part of my game, and I learned a huge amount from Sean.
I mean, we're only a few minutes into this podcast, but we've gone straight into the rugby detail about positioning and things like that. So I guess who go over this sort of 8-week period, you've been missing rugby like all of us so much, but obviously it's been such a massive part of your life and it's just been sort of taken away from us. How are you sort of dealing with that aspect at the moment?
First couple of weeks, I genuinely struggled just because I love my job. I'm really passionate about my job and it helped me retire. It really helped me retire in that transition just mentally, because you've been a part of this thing and you've dedicated your whole life, your whole being, and it's been a part of who you are. And my week, although I probably work 3 days a week, just say for BT and I do the podcast on a Monday at the BBC, the rest of it, you're reading articles, you're on the phone, you're prepping, I'm watching footage to make sure that when we go live, whether it's a game or podcast, whatever I'm doing, I can speak with real authority and I'm really clued up. So it does take up a large part of your week. You have that taken out of it and all of a sudden you feel a little bit naked, you feel a little bit bare. And I missed that, not just from a work sense, but almost from a chemical sense. I was having this chat the other week. I think when you retire, there's certain things which you miss, the endorphins, the ability to know that you're achieving something every single week, but more so than anything, that adrenaline rush. It's hard to replace that. And I genuinely get a buzz when I commentate. You know, you think of the big games, fireworks going off, you look down the team sheet and you feel like, wow, this is going to be, I can't wait for that head-to-head or for this to happen. You've already kind of, the same what I would visualise a game before I played a game, you visualise it before you commentate on it. And so all of that just went out of your system, just like that. So yeah, I have missed it. But, you know, of course, just like everyone, you understand the situation you're in and you kind of settle into your new life. And I've kind of gone from like a full-time rugby pundit to a full-time dad with chatting about rugby part time, probably still to a level which my missus is not quite happy with. So I'm eager. I'm keen, just as everyone is, to get rugby back up and running.
I guess sort of the Looseheads Instagram lives as well, Hugo, have kind of fed that hunger for rugby to come back. But I know you've been doing the FIFA challenge as well for BT Sport. I guess that's not quite the same as the adrenaline rush you were talking about there.
I've not played FIFA for about 10 years and I'm captain of the Red Roses, which comprised of Danny Kerr, Anthony Watson, Ellis Genge. I mean, that's been fun. That's just literally me just having fun and stepping into a new territory. But the Instagram lives of Looseheads have been great. The one thing I miss about rugby is being part of a team and just like having that just inane like rubbish banter in the change room. And as much as we're obviously out there trying to raise awareness of mental health, it's been great just to chat to the lads. Like Jamie Roberts, we chatted to him on Sunday. I've not spoken to him in ages. So when I'm asking the question, how are you doing? I'm not saying that because it's a list of questions I've got to get through. It's because I want to know, like, how are you? Like, what's going on? James Haskell, the same, and one of my best mates, Danny Caron, but also like Elton Yanchis. He's someone I've done a little bit of work with when he played for the Barbarians. I think it was last year or the year before, but I don't really know the bloke. So when I'm asking about his last year and how South Africa have helped rejuvenate and give hope to a nation, I'm really interested, you know. So I've loved that from a selfish perspective, but then also understanding these players who are in a privileged position to be able to affect people's lives. So the messages which are coming out are really strong. So it's actually just been really nice for me, myself, and hopefully for the thousands of people that have been tuning in, that they've really got something beneficial out of it too.
I'm sure you can echo that, Mark, that a lot of people have been benefiting from the chats that Hugo's been having with some of these big stars in the game.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle for my generation to understand what Instagram is. And they've taken 3 weeks to get used to it. But actually, to be fair, when they have got used to it, they're all properly engaged with it. We're here in a privileged position talking to Hugo. Hugo's a proper professional, not just a professional rugby player, but he's a professional presenter. And he does that. He makes it seem like it's effortless. And I think that's the trick. We all know it's not effortless. It takes an awful lot of input. So we're delighted to be associated with Hugo Monier.
Dave, I've got to say, some of the questions that Hugo's had to read out on the quiz, they're very, very difficult. Yeah, for me, they're very tough.
I must admit, when we were putting a few of them together, particularly some of the names from Russia and Japan, we wasted breath. But in fairness, he got through them. You did bloody well.
Oh, mate, two gins down, having to pronounce Georgia the Russian's name. I was like, wow. But it was great. I've actually nicked some of those questions. We had a BT Sport quiz a couple of weeks ago, and I robbed a couple of those. So thank you. I'll tell you one thing that lockdown must have brought to everyone in this country. Everyone's IQ and ability to be able to rattle their way through quizzes and general knowledge has gone through the roof. Because like everyone, I'm sure we've all been on countless Zoom quiz nights.
Just to go to more the serious side of things, Hugo, with Rob mentioned there how much of a privilege it is to have you on board with Looseheads. But what was kind of the first sort of notice that you had of Looseheads, and why did you want to get involved personally with the guys?
I've actually seen some of the branding out there on Twitter. I'm obviously very aware of some of the ambassadors that they work with, and I guess more than anything, the one that triggered me to it was just, I was actually having a conversation with Maru Toje last summer. I'm actually in the process of setting up a foundation with the RFU and just wanted to challenge current players and myself. Because when I move on from my job, when I retired, the fact is, as much as people pump up your ties and you've got a great CV and you've got loads of medals and trophies and wins and all these amazing stats, there will be someone to replace you. There will be another one. So the question is, like, what will be your legacy? Like, what's it going to be? How can you affect people outside of your game? And last summer was a really good summer. I think some great examples out of that. So I remember looking at Coco Gauff, played at Wimbledon, you know, amazing. You've got this teenager playing at Wimbledon, and as much as her talent is undisputed, she's having a real impact and effect outside of that. I look at Lewis Hamilton. He won Silverton for a record amount of times. I looked at Ripponaud, the USA women's captain. They won another World Cup. And there's a long list of achievers. Joffre Archer, his story of where he came from to then playing in a World Cup and everything which he's done. You look at, I'm not going to forgive myself for this. Oh, cricketer, tattoo, unbelievable, super over.
Stokes.
Ben Stokes.
His story of just redemption. So I guess the message was, as much as these guys and girls are super talented, it's actually their story which has the ability to be able to transcend sport. So I just got thinking about the legacy that I want to live. And that's obviously quite a big word. It almost sounds quite grand. And I don't mean it in that terms at all. But I guess what I want to get, what I'm trying to say is, you know, there will be another Marrow, there will be another Owen Farrell, there will be another me, there'll be another one of all of us. But what can you actually do which have a far greater impact than the career that you ever had? And there's topics which are often difficult to talk about. And actually removing that stigma and raising awareness for issues like mental health, because to a certain degree, we all suffer from it. Whether you're aware of it or not, in reflection, you might look back at a few years and think, oh, that was the time where I really struggled. I didn't quite know what it was and I wasn't able to tackle it in a meaningful way. So that's why I wanted to be a part of this, because there's lots of guys, and I'm fortunate enough to have retired and still enjoying what I do, but I know with rugby players especially, but I think it actually applies to all sportsmen and women, that either suffer mentally, financially or physically. And I've got friends that have suffered all three, who need hip replacements, have no money, and then that cycle then turns into mental health and disaster. So what can we do? How can we start a conversation? How can we get people feeling happy about having these conversations and feeling that it's not emasculated in any kind of way? So that was fairly long-winded, but that's the reason why I wanted to get involved in it. And I kind of think, you know, you've already spoken about it through your apparel and selling T-shirts and hoodies. It's cool streetwear. And I think that targets a certain demographic. It's cool the way in which your social media set up, and it's engaging to that younger demographic once again, that generation X or Z or whatever it's called these days. So being able to speak to those guys, I think is really, really important. And I think Loose Heads do it, not just because there's lots of great mental health charities out there, but I think Loose Heads do it in quite a unique fashion as well. So that's exactly why I wanted to be part of it. Sorry, that was really long. But yeah, quite a long story of the reason why to come into here where I am today.
That's a full endorsement there.
Yeah.
You've got to be more than just your talent. Like, you have to be, because go back 10 years ago, there were superstars. Johnny Wilson's a superstar. Before him, there was a superstar. There's going to be another one. Owen Farrell took the shirt off Johnny, and then someone's going to take the shirt off Owen, and that's great. You go down to history, you go back to your clubs, and you'll be on the honours board. That's great, but is that all you want to be remembered for, or do you want to do something a bit more meaningful? I'm not to say play for England, play the Premiership, winning trophies isn't meaningful. That's great, but other guys and girls are going to go and do that as well. Do something out of your comfort zone and actually have an impact on society.
Absolutely, Hugo. You mentioned sort of those people before doing the Instagram lives, and you know, the people like Jimmy Gopherth, etc., being able to talk about, you know, their experiences, why it's important to raise awareness for mental health. And I mean, you guys on the BBC Rugby Union Weekly, right at the start of the year, and right, Hugo, you and Danny Kerr and Chris Ashens talked really well about the use of social media and the links to mental health. And we touched on there that Loose Heads use social media so well to promote what they're doing. But yeah, I think it was around the time that Danny Cipriani said it was important to talk about mental well-being, and you guys opened up about your personal experience is on social media and the mental health aspects around that. Just how important is it to focus on social media and try and use it in a positive way when it comes to mental health awareness?
Well, it's kind of a juxtaposition, isn't it, social media? Because the word social would almost make you believe that it's a nice, happy place to be. But often, especially Twitter's a cesspit. It allows and gives people a platform to project positivity in a way which Loose Heads do, but also allows people to be faceless and attack people in a cowardly manner. And that's the part where I think there needs to be far better governance for and accountability. There was a story just the other week of Ian Wright and how he got racially attacked. And, you know, Ian Wright's a tough bloke. You know, he's gone through a lot in his life and he's achieved a huge amount, but you can't tell me that's not affected him. So I just wanted to shine a light. And I shared some personal stories about me and my wife, and I unfortunately had a miscarriage. And then, you know, I went and commentated. I found out just before I commentated on the game, you commentate on the game and, you know, my head's in a million and one places, probably not at Allianz Park that day, but you try and crack on and do your job. And then just as you do out of habit, you go onto Twitter and you're just getting abuse. And you're thinking, really? Like, really? In fact, I had a pop. I'll mention them, Rugby Dump. I think they do some brilliant stuff. But they put a post on Facebook, which I don't follow them on Facebook. I rarely use it. But a couple of my friends screenshotted it saying, mate, they're coming after you. So I had a look at the article, went onto Facebook, and it was a picture of me in the classic old school purple England shirt after my performance against Argentina. Undoubtedly the worst performance I ever had in my whole life. I'm not talking about professional life, like talking under 13s, I just never played the worst game. I came out straight after the game. I remember the press officer saying, do you want to do media? I said, absolutely. I'll do media if I got mad at the match. So I'm going to do it when I'm crap. Came out, said I was awful. And their article was about the top three worst performances of all time. And they suggested that my performance was up there as well. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. It's my job to critique as well as, you know, pat people on the back as well. But I actually replied to them and said, why during a period of total uncertainty when people are struggling, hours after Mental Health Awareness Week has just finished, where the whole nation's behind it and trying to project positivity, why would you have an article like this? And it's not because I was embarrassed about it. You've only got to put it into Google and you can see it for yourself, and everyone wants to have a good giggle, go and search for it and have a laugh. But why is there a need for people to project negativity out there during a time when people are really struggling? There's a million and one topics you could talk about. Everyone needs to create more content, more so than ever, because there isn't rugby to talk about. Talking about rugby without there being rugby. But for me, it's far easier to be able to knock people down than big them up. Well, I just wanted to question their rationale. It was just so bizarre. Shock, horror, they didn't reply back to me. I just don't understand the need for that behaviour. But then, if you're allowed to behave in a certain way and get no repercussions, why would you ever stop? So I was trying to educate those people, but also support the people that are deeply affected by it.
Yeah, 100%, Hugo. And I mean, the work that you're doing for Loose Heads just echoes exactly why it's important to talk about mental health awareness. So as Rob and the guys have said, it's brilliant to have you on the podcast today and talk about sort of the work you're doing with Loose Heads. But if you don't mind now going on to sort of your rugby career, if you don't mind, Hugo. And I mean,
of course.
It's sort of, for you, we had Sean Edwards on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about doing athletics and rugby at the same time. And he said he was doing 400 metres at school, and then it was rugby for him. And was it sort of similar for you in terms of athletics and rugby at the time when you were starting out in the sport?
Massively. I wanted to be a footballer. I wanted to play for Arsenal. And then I went to posh school who didn't play football. They said it was for chavs. So I was like, fair enough. Right, rugby it is. So I took my barber jacket off and put my rugby jersey on, and that was that. You know, that they laid the pathway for me to become a rugby player. But I guess with rugby and athletics, it kind of dovetailed quite well, because obviously the sport's seasonal, and the one thing I've learned and everyone's aware of is that lots of skills are transferable, especially when you play on the wing. So the athletics season was really important for athletics, but then it massively helped me when I went into the rugby season. I loved it, but at some point you've got to make a decision. You can't inject all your energy into just one field and into both fields and be That's my baby screaming. If you can hear it, if you want to reach the top of your game, so had some trials at Harlequins and they offered me a contract, and I thought at the time it'd be stupid to take it. Stupid not to take it, and I guess that's where the path to professional rugby really started for me.
Because Mark mentioned yesterday you were the same school as Johnny Wilkinson. If that's right, Hugo. So there was rugby quite a mainstay at the school then in terms of sport.
It's quite a small rugby school, I've got right. to say, but they've actually produced lots of good rugby players. So at one time, Peter Richards, former England scrum half, was the number 9 to Johnny Wilkinson. Like, that's a decent halfback combo at schoolboy level. I think they got to the semi-finals of Daily Mail Cup. Charlie Ainsbury, who played for Harlequins, I think he went on to Newcastle, was there. Steve Bates. He was a chemistry teacher at North Taunton College. He was the guy who scouted Johnny Wilson, took him up to Newcastle Falcons. So they got a fairly rich rugby history, but we used to love rugby at school. And I remember being a schoolboy, age 15, stood on the sideline with the bin from your dormitory, like, and some utensil, just using it as a drum, just to cheer along, like, the first 15. So, like, playing for the first 15 was, I guess, the equivalent of like playing for the first team NFL out in America, just to a far lesser degree. We didn't have 100,000 people cheering us on. We had a few parents, a few dogs and a few school kids. But we loved it. It was a huge sense of kudos if you played for the first team. I've still got my first 15 jersey. It means that much to me. It was a big part of it. But I also learned, I didn't always adopt, but I learned some really good habits from Johnny at school. He was an unbelievable student as well as professional sportsman. And he's one of those annoying people where journalists will speak to you, have you got any dirty secrets of him? Have you got anything like this? Like, he went out with the head girl, who was an A-grade student. He was in the first team for cricket, played basketball, was unbelievable quite clearly at rugby as well. And some of his habits were just, in inverted commas, abnormal as a teenager. Aged 15, whilst we were dossing around in our break time, his dad would come in and he would practice his goal kicking. He'd practice his kicking out of hand after school, after rugby training. He'd be out on the pitch practicing all of his like rugby-specific drills. And we looked at it, didn't pay much attention, and funnily enough, not all of us went on to kick a winning drop goal and win a World Cup. But you can see from an early age, just when you kind of work back from that drop goal to him being a 15-year-old kid, there's absolutely no surprise as to why he achieved the things he did, because part of it's talent, of course, but in terms of desire and just having that level of motivation, that's something you can't quite teach, I don't think.
And you mentioned as well there, Hugo, sort of you were 15, you were playing for the first 15 at school. And I've been right in saying it, just a few years later, you were part of the England Sevens setup, if that's right. That must have been some experience for you to come out of school and be part of that experience.
That was mental. Like, genuinely, it was crazy. But once again, it was a real good opportunity for me off the back of a negative. So we had England under-19 trials. And I turned up and we had guys like Marcel Garvey, James Bailey, who had done all the age-grade rugby. I'd never done age-grade rugby. Played for Hampshire 16s, but not a national level. And I turned up and I trained really well for the 3 days that were there. We had a game at the end and played well, and I scored, and I didn't make the England under-19 squad, and I just thought that just wasn't fair. I was really, really frustrated. I worked so hard to get to that point, but I wanted more, so I didn't get picked. Anyway, I think the week following, I played for the second team against the British Army out at Aldershot, and the fields there are horrific. The coach at the time, I think it was Joe Lydon, right, he came and watched and scored a couple of tries, and he spoke to Mark Evans, our CEO, and went, "We like him. We really like him." And Mark was really nice about me and gave me a glow report. Next thing you know, I'm off to Brisbane business class to play for England Sevens. I was like, "What is this? Like, this is nuts." A, I've never turned left on a plane. B, I've never been to Australia. And C, how have I just been upgraded out of the England under-19s to play on the World Seven Series? And it was a remarkable week, just getting to explore the country, be part of this institution and be part of the World Seven. It's just amazing. And then we won. We won. We won our first ever World 7 Series tournament, and I got Player of the Series. So it was just like, this is a bit of a turnaround. So that was just a nuts week. I landed on the Monday. Funnily enough, I got called by England under-19 and said, oh, you're back in the squad. Just started against Scotland at the weekend. So I played against Scotland, score two, and I was a bit like, actually, when they called me, I was a bit like, you know, I was that same player just 2 weeks ago, but you chose to ignore it. So anyway, it's fine. I love proving people wrong. Scored two tries in my debut. It was just unbelievable. But those years of playing on the 7 Series was a brilliant pathway to understand what it's like to play on a big test arena. Obviously, 7s is so intense, a little bit like a goldfish bowl. There is no hiding place. And I had to accelerate my learning quite quickly. You go from Brisbane to New Zealand, played in a Hong Kong Sevens, things I was watching on TV, and players, you're in amongst legends of the game. So that as an experience from like 19 through to 21, 22 was just unbelievable. Travel the world, like, how cool is that?
Did that experience kind of help you gain more confidence with Harlequins than Hugo? Because, I mean, the impact you had when you first got there was incredible. It was quite easy for everyone to see that talent you had, and you're obviously playing in the second tier as well to help Harlequins get back into the Premiership. But from a personal point of view, did your Sevens experience and all that had with it help you really kick on at Harlequins?
It did. The one thing I had to learn quite quick is 7 to 15 to different games. And yeah. I was a young player, just playing with instinct. I got the ball in 7s, and every time I caught the ball, I thought I'd score. In 15s, it's not quite the same. There's times, age 19, where you just wanted to counterattack 5 minutes of your try line, which is exciting for people watching in, but it's not going to impress your national coach. So as much as it probably brought the best out of my natural talent, it did also make me realise that not only have you got to be a good athlete, you've got to be a good student of the game. And so accelerated that learning for sure. But I loved it. You know, you're just young. No one's got any expectations. People don't really know who you are, which is great. So I just used my natural talent to be able to do the things I was doing back then. And the confidence I got from playing sevens and winning trophies. Hadn't won anything, you know, at that point. But then, travel around the world, you're winning tournaments, you're feeling unbeatable. So that kind of confidence, which I was able to take onto the 15th pitch, really helped me for sure.
And I touched on there about Quinn's playing in the second tier. And I think around the time that Saracens' relegation was confirmed this year, Hugo, you guys on the podcast talked about sort of how much you kind of enjoyed playing the Championship. I mean, how much should English rugby value the second tier at the moment? I know the sort of the funding's being caught and et cetera, but it is such a great breeding ground for players and players to learn the skills as well.
Yeah, players, coaches and referees. I loved my time eventually in the Championship. I didn't want to get relegated with Harlequins. I just got selected in 2005 for my first England tour. So I felt my career was going one way and the club was doing another thing. And I asked to leave and the club wouldn't let me leave. But then I look at the Championship as the birthplace for a lot of the English qualified and Harlequins legends that we see now. So your Mike Browns, your Chris Robshaws, your Joe Marlers, Jordan Turner Halls, Danny Cares, all of us were able just to use that year and just that fun. We developed our identity, our Quinn style, or that's what we called it anyway. So it was a brilliant experience. I think the Championship needs to be respected. It probably could do with better funding, but you're not able to do, the RFU have an unbelievable task of trying to cut their cloth accordingly. Where I'd like to see the game grow is actually in amongst the university games. I look at what they do college football in America. Imagine if we had a system or a league that could resemble something similar to that. Lots of people go to uni to play rugby, whether it's as a pathway into the Championship and then into the Premiership, or they do it for a social level. But imagine, I look at some Championship games and I reckon there's some big university games that are getting bigger crowds.
Yeah,
and if we can amplify that more and fund it more, then that could be a superb league in isolation or a superb pathway into the professional game as well.
definitely. Couldn't agree with you more on that, Hugo. And you mentioned sort of the guys that you know, managed to get promotion with from the Championships. And I saw this week Danny Kerr posted a picture on Twitter with a big trophy of the Premiership 8 years ago this week. I mean, kind of just go back to that moment for us, Hugo. I mean, what are your memories of that final and how much did it mean to the club because of where the guys had come from that promotion to the Championship to lifting the big trophy in 2012?
Yeah, to have the group of players that all got relegated together, had to endure that, supporters, everyone from the owner all the way down who supported us through Bloodgate to then winning a title was just, it was truly incredible because I use this analogy a lot, but it's not even an analogy, it's a comparison. But the class of 92 Man United, the Nevilles and Scholes and the Beckhams, of this world, I felt like that was our class as well, because they weren't just professional teammates; they were like lifelong friends. And the bond we had in that dressing room, the bond we had in that club was unrivaled. You look at squads nowadays, and in terms of strength and conditioning, tactical awareness, coaching standards are all on an even keel. But the one thing I think sets the top teams are part of the culture and the camaraderie, and it couldn't have been topped. It's the best group of players I've ever been with, and I loved it. Being in the change room afterwards and knowing for the last decade we've grown up together. I've known all your strengths, your weaknesses. I've known your trials and tribulations to reach the pinnacle of the English game was just unbelievable. I mean, on a personal level, I tore my hamstring really badly 5 weeks previous when we played Leicester at home. I think we lost like 44-20. And I was really touch and go to play that final. I spoke to one of the Leicester players after and he went, how did you play? Because one of the coaches was asked to play Cammy in the warm-up. The coach came back, spoke to Richard Cocker, went, nah, there's no way he's playing. Because I was honestly, my left hamstring was held together with tape. And I tested my hamstring after, had to do physio and all the rest of it. And I had 30% strength in my left hamstring. But there was no way I was not going to play that game. We'd waited almost 150 years as a club to win an English title to then not be there. Like, you've got to be kidding me. So I think there's some times where your mind takes your body to places it perhaps doesn't want to go, but will just go. And that's why we're chatting today, because we're talking about mental health and mental awareness and the ability to be able to take control of your mind, whether it's for good or for bad. And in that moment in 2012, I was able to take my body to a place through mental toughness, but I was never going to miss out on that day. And I certainly made sure that I made the most of it that night and for probably quite a few nights afterwards as well. It was unbelievable.
I was going to say, where was the destination for the summer holiday? Was it Ibiza or Las Vegas, Hugo? Because I know you've been talking about those two places quite a lot recently.
Yeah, I have. So we had a Super Saturday followed by Super Sunday. We had a tour to South Africa with England. And then after that holiday, it felt like a holiday. We took a battle, I think, by South Africa. But then we went to Las Vegas after. So Danny Kerr, Jordan Turner Hall, myself, went to Las Vegas and pulled in a late recruit, Paul Doran Jones. We went to Las Vegas and just, wow. I think we're there 5 days. It felt like a month. And I remember one of the last days, we ended up at a pool party. We were like pretty hungover, not feeling our best. We'll have a beer. Because I'm of the strong opinion, and I'm not advocating drinking irresponsibly. After a hangover, I always think you're three beers away from like being back on the horse properly again. Like, the first one's horrific. Like, just take your time. The second one, third one, you're doing cartwheels again. You're back. You can feel the music. You know, your body's back in sync again. And here we go. And that's what happened that day. So like a bottle turned into a few, and a few bottles of beer turned into some champagne, and we're loving life. And we walk back into the hotel. And if you've ever been to Vegas, like, everything's in the hotels, the restaurants, the bars, the shops, and the tattoo parlours. Walk past the tattoo parlours, like, lads, we're getting tattoos. What are we getting? I don't know. I'll think of something. And we sat in this tattoo parlour, And I scribbled something down. I was like, right, that's what we're getting done. Are we all in? Right, we're in. Bang. I'm lying down in this bed now. The tattoo gun goes. I'm getting a tattoo. I look around and the lads are up there. So I'm panicking. I was like, hey, wait, stop. You've got to finish now. You've started. But lads, I need you to get these done. So I've got the other boys in and I'm not going to tell you what it is because it is, it's just so embarrassing. But the four of us all got the same matching tattoo in Las Vegas in 2012.
I think you talked about that with Danny actually on the Rugby Union Weekly, but he didn't reveal it then. And I was hoping this time you were going to reveal it, Hugo. But
yeah, we'll save it for another pod because I'm not even quite sure what Mum knows about it.
Okay, yeah.
Because I remember later that summer, I did this ad campaign for Molton Brown. I did a lot of work with them, and they were releasing this new shower gel and like lotion and stuff. So I did this like naked photo shoot. So it's like this cringe picture of me stood like looking over my shoulder, like brutal. Anyway, they've got a store up in Regent Street and they said, we're going to have you as a massive poster. Genuinely, they said massive poster. I reckon this thing is 20 foot tall, about 6 foot wide. So sent me the imagery of the store. I was like, whoa, this is like amazing. Just my mum goes to church at the top of Regent Street. And I did tell her I did it, but I wanted it to be a surprise. And I said, would you mind just popping to Molton Brown? Just grab us a couple of bits. Anyway, she walked past. And she saw this naked body. She ran. She was like, son, I've just seen you, Molton Brown. Wow, like this is, it's amazing. When did you do this? Like, oh, well done, son. You look fantastic, blah, blah, blah. She went, what's that weird writing on your bum? I was like, oh, it's just this logo that they've got. It's all part of the campaign, so I've just like blagged it and bluffed it the whole way. But I've got a picture of all four of us, and I do need to unleash it at some point. But as you can tell, it's not great because I'm embarrassed still, 8 years later.